History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there really are stories there right around you, maybe even right next door, that should not go untold. We've learned they don't have to go untold if we'll just find the willingness to ask a few questions and the patience to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in the process, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. When it comes to the value of freedom, you're never going to find a more powerful perspective than what you'll hear from someone who's had to live in the absence of freedom. And William Sanchez of Monterey Park, California, spent more than 3 years as a prisoner of the Empire of Japan. 79 years ago this week, on May 6th, 1942, he entered captivity after the fall of Corregidor in the Philippines. We are going to hear some of his memories about how that all unfolded. He was 23 at the time, and now he's nearly 103. But let's start earlier on with some of his memories from childhood.
I was an orphan, and I was brought up by an aunt and an uncle. And they had kids of their own, but they took on three of us, my sister and my brother. So it was a full house. But we all got along, and things went pretty good.
And how old were you when that happened?
I was in my teens, and we all got along. Times were different, but fortunately, everything turned out all right.
Mm-hmm. And how old were you when you started boxing?
Oh, I was a teenager.
Did your brother teach you how?
Yes. He was sort of my manager, and we had a lot of fun with it. Things went rather well, so we were able to do a lot of things that most people don't get to do. We got to travel and perform at different functions and met high-caliber people. I had a good life.
Did you ever box against your brother?
No. He'd whip me up.
How much older was he?
6 years old.
Uh-huh.
He was 6 years older.
And where did you grow up?
In Huntington Park. I hung around there for a long time with an aunt and uncle, so I had no place to go. They took me in.
And, you know, these days, when we think about Southern California, there's not a lot of space between Los Angeles and any of the other cities in this area. What was it like back then?
Well, Los Angeles was pretty active, and if you had some connections there, you would do real well. And I was fortunate I had connections.
What kind of connections?
Like a brother, a sister, some relative of sorts. Things went rather well.
And now, sports fans in Los Angeles have the Dodgers and the Lakers, and now the Rams are back.
We didn't have that at the time, but they came in, they fit real well, and so we kept them.
So when you were growing up, it was what? USC and UCLA?
That's it. College, mostly.
And the Pacific Coast League for baseball?
That's it.
And boxing?
Yeah, boxing was always there.
So who were your favorite boxers?
I had very many of them. I was right in the middle of things, so I had accessibility to most everything.
And how good a boxer was your big brother?
He was a good boxer. He won several championships, and he was a good boxer.
So he was a Golden Gloves champion?
Yes.
And your son David was telling me a story where his boxing career, his boxing prowess, helped you get some needed medical treatment when you were ill.
That's right. Because of his connections, I got some good medical treatment.
And you were actually on the other side of the border in Mexico when this happened?
Well, yes. But he went down there and he brought me up here because it was better for me here than it was down there.
Have you ever wondered what would have happened if he didn't do that?
I hate to think.
So he was a pretty big part of your life.
He was my life.
Hmm.
Everything I needed, he took care of. He was a real big brother.
And so when you were a teenager, you would go from Huntington Park all the way to Hollywood to sell programs at the big boxing matches?
I would sell programs at the Olympic Auditorium on Mondays and Tuesdays. Monday was boxing, Tuesdays wrestling, and I got to move around pretty good.
How would you get over there?
Bicycles.
You'd ride your bike?
All the way.
How many miles is that?
Well, that's from Los Angeles to Hollywood. It was a long way, but I used to manage to use my bike rather well.
Well, these days you could probably get there faster on a bike than a car sitting in traffic on the freeway.
Most likely, yes.
Are there some big names from boxing or wrestling that we might recognize that you got to see compete because of that role?
Most likely, yes, because I got to see all the big matches and everything.
So are we talking like Joe Louis, Jack Dempsey? Who were some of the boxers you got to see fight?
Oh, they were local boxers, Enrique Milanos and fellows that came from Mexico. And it was just a real thing that was going on.
And is that what you wanted to do with your life?
I just was glad to be part of it.
And what was your boxing style when you fought?
More of a boxer than a slugger.
So you were more of a defensive boxer?
Yes.
And is that something that you wanted to pursue for a career?
Not necessarily, no. But it fit into the pattern real well. They offered me to go to UCLA on a boxing scholarship.
And why did you decide not to do that?
I didn't want to get tied down.
This is before World War II.
Yes, it is.
And how was it that you came to think, you know, maybe the Army is a good path for me?
Well, in those days, you had to give a hitch in the armed forces at one time or another. So that was a necessary thing, something that wasn't now, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you decided, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going in the Army.
Yes. I had a good hitch at the Army, so things went pretty well.
What were your first impressions? What were some of your welcome to the Army moments that you recall?
Well, there were many, but it was surprising how well I fit into the things going on. It came up rather easy for me. A tough nut to crack, but once you get inside, it was okay.
I understand that you volunteered to go overseas?
Yes.
Why would you do that?
I was seeking adventure.
And was that going to have an impact on how long your time in the Army was?
Yes, it was. I made one hitch overseas, and that was enough for me.
Well, especially when we understand what you went through over there.
Yes.
Had you learned about the Philippines in school or anything? Did you know where it was when you were headed there?
Not as much as I should have, but there was quite a difference in there.
Well, what was that like, heading that far away from home?
It was very difficult at times. I was a teenager. I wanted to go overseas, so it was a good opportunity for me to learn something. Things come about real fast, and you have to be ready for them.
And you were assigned to Corregidor.
Right.
Had you ever heard of that before?
No. All I heard about was The Rock. It was a little island, and there was a lot of activity all the time. But it was a good experience.
And what was it like there before December 7th, 1941?
Oh, December 7th changed everything. You're coasting right along, and all of a sudden, it's like an explosion. Things change fast.
Because just a few hours after they bombed Pearl Harbor and the installations in Hawaii, they struck the Philippines.
Right. So the Philippines took quite a beating.
And I guess right before that, there had been the spotting of a Japanese fleet, so there was some suspicion?
Yes, they had spotted some up in the islands in Japan to sort of threaten our security. Times were different then, and it was difficult to accept the aggression of the Japanese. They wanted to dominate.
And you would see firsthand some of the worst
Yes.
Examples of that.
That's right.
What was the first thing you remember about when they attacked where you were? What did you see and hear and experience?
Well, so many things happen, and so many things happen fast that you really didn't have time to think. You just acted accordingly, you know, according to the situation. I was right on Corregidor, right on the rock.
Uh-huh. And people who know some of that history know that after the Japanese attack, eventually when the Bataan Peninsula fell and there was the death march, and they've heard about MacArthur leaving. And when MacArthur left, you were one who stayed behind.
That's right. We were left behind, not by choice, but it happened.
How did you feel about that at the time?
Not too good. The treatment wasn't very good at all.
And how about your supplies? Did you guys have the normal supplies you should have had?
No, not quite. We had to do without a lot of things, but we managed.
And as the Bataan Death March is happening across the way in April of 1942, are you guys getting updates? Are you aware of what's happening there?
We were pretty well up to date, yes. We knew what was happening at most posts. It was a difficult time for us.
How much time did you spend in the Malinta Tunnel?
Few months.
Yeah.
It was our only place we could sort of do our own thing. Those were hard days.
Yeah, as I try to imagine myself in your shoes.
Yeah.
And it seems like that's a pretty unique place to be, where you'd be pretty isolated and cut off from the rest of the world.
That's about true. Yes. You had no contact with the outside world.
And did you have a sense that at some point your capture was unavoidable?
Well, we knew it was going to happen, so we just went along with it. We had a very, very hard time. We had no say in the matter.
And after December 7th, we've got the rest of December and January and February and March and April. How often during that time were the Japanese bombing where you were and strafing Corregidor where you were?
They came repeatedly. They had no opposition whatsoever, so they came at will.
So that was just something you had to get used to?
That's it. You had to accept. You don't get used to it, but you have to accept it. It was a tough life. It was rough.
What do you remember about Cinco de Mayo in 1942?
Nothing but bad things. Everything that happened was bad.
That was the day they invaded Corregidor.
Right.
And at that point, they knew you had experience with machine guns, so they sent you out to a machine gun post?
Yes, I was at a machine gun post on the defense site. Life wasn't easy. It just, one bad thing after another would happen.
One of the reasons you've touched so many lives and inspired so many people is that you've made it through all this and you've survived all this.
That's it. I was able to endure, and I try to make things less difficult.
How did you do that?
Well, you roll with the punches and do the best you can. You accept it.
So on May 5th, after months of shelling, bombing, strafing, the Japanese are finally on your island.
That's it.
And they actually knocked out your machine gun post, right?
They did. They overwhelmed us. Their superiority was something that we couldn't endure.
But even though they hit your position, you weren't wounded and none of the men with you were?
We had some wounded, but it could have been worse.
And you went back to the tunnel?
Yes, sir. You had no freedom at all.
Well, and that was really going to be the case once the decision was made to surrender.
That's it. Actually, we didn't know what would happen at the surrender, but we found out real soon that things weren't going to be pleasant.
Well, and I want to hear about that. But before we get to that, let me ask you a question that is relevant today at age 102 and a half, because I'm sure that every once in a while you see the flag, your flag,
yes,
the Stars and Stripes. What do you think about when you see that flag?
You take a lot of pride in that.
And there was a flag, a big giant flag, flying above your post on Corregidor?
Yes.
And I understand you were asked to take that flag down so the Japanese wouldn't get it?
Yes. We tried to preserve the flag itself so that it wouldn't fall into Japanese hands. we took the flag down and we hit it.
And it had been shot up a little bit, I guess, right?
It had a few shell shots on it, yes, quite a bit.
So did someone tell you to tear it into little pieces, or was that your idea?
No, it came about. I wouldn't say it was my idea, but it was the only thing we could think of. We tore it into little pieces so that it wouldn't fall into enemy hands. Once it was the little pieces, we just kept it. They wanted the flag in toto, and they didn't have the chance to get it.
I'm just imagining, you know, obviously you're someone who signed up to defend your country, and now you're overseas in a very difficult situation defending your country, and now you're having to take apart the emblem of your country. Was that an emotional experience?
Yes, it was. But you had to accept it, and that's what we did.
Were there some tears during that process?
Yes, there was. Quite a few.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but I believe that I heard you mention before or read about it, that you made a statement at the time as you're completing this task that you never asked for, that the situation presented to you, about hoping no one else ever had to do that, what you were doing.
That's right. It was a very bad experience.
And I'm not trying to make you dwell in a bad experience. It's for us to understand what you went through helps us appreciate more what we have, what you and so many others paid for.
Yes. Yes, it was a very difficult time for us.
And things were only going to become more difficult, more dangerous, more dire. But William Sanchez is a survivor. It's time for our first break, but we're going to hear more from this 102-year-old ex-prisoner of war when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck, 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 102-year-old William Sanchez of Monterey Park, California. He was serving with the 59th Coast Artillery on Corregidor when it fell to the Japanese on May 6, 1942. In holding off the enemy there for 5 months after the attacks that brought America into the war, those undersupplied but courageous American forces bought enough time for the U.S. to regroup with a new base of operations in Australia. That would prove pretty important through the rest of the war, but it all came at a heavy cost. Like the thousands who survived the Bataan Death March a month earlier, those captured on Corregidor would spend the next 3+ years in captivity. Do you remember, Mr. Sanchez, what that felt like when you heard that the general had reluctantly ordered all 11,000 troops on Corregidor, all the Filipinos and all the Americans like you, to surrender?
Well, you can't forget that. You knew you were going to lose your freedom, so it was a hard thing to accept.
Did you ever think you were going to lose your life?
Yes, all the time. At any time, you figured this might be your last moment.
And when that surrender happened, you probably had no idea what to expect from the Japanese, right?
Right. We had no idea what was going to happen to us.
What did happen to you? What was the first thing they had you do?
Most of it was bad treatment and things that you don't really expect, but you have to endure.
And you were still a very young man.
I was a very young kid, yes.
You're in your early 20s. At this point, you're 23. Do you think that some of what you'd already endured in your life prepared you to handle that?
Yes. It was a good experience to be able to handle what was coming.
Mm.
And you don't wish it on other people.
So now you're a prisoner.
Yes.
And you have no idea how long you're going to be a prisoner.
That's the worst part.
So how did you face that? What gave you the strength or the hope to endure, to persist, to persevere?
Well, you never lose hope. You always think something better is going to happen. And you go on that basis. Things can't get worse.
But for you, as I understand your story, after you're a prisoner, they did get worse. The Japanese gave you a real brutal task.
The Japanese were real bad. It's something we had to learn to endure.
And they made you pile up all the bodies of the Americans and Filipinos who've been killed there?
Yes. They made us take care of all the bodies and everything, and we thought it would never end.
And then what did they do with those bodies that they forced you to gather?
Oh, they just piled them up, carted them up, and set fire to it. They weren't very kind. And all in all, it was a very bad experience. But it was something that had to be endured.
And so this is 1942. And as I said, you didn't know how long, but it was going to be a long time until you tasted freedom again.
Yes. It was a very difficult time at the time.
Can you help us understand what life in captivity was like and what some of the things you had to face and endure were?
It is very difficult to try to explain what we endured. It's unbelievable, but it happened.
Is it okay if I ask you a few questions about some of it?
Yes.
And I realize that this is something you had to survive one day at a time for more than 3 years.
You never knew what was going to happen the next day. From day to day, you learn to live life.
Were there some people that you were with that helped you?
We all helped each other. There was many bad things we had to learn to endure, and we all helped each other.
You know, one thing that I think most people listening can identify with or maybe can get a frame of reference from, since we all have to eat to survive, maybe people would be interested to hear what your menu consisted of as a prisoner of war.
Leftovers. What they didn't eat, they would feed us.
Is it fair to say that you ended up eating some things you never thought you'd eat?
That is true. It was a rough time in life that you don't even like to think about.
And we talked about you being a boxer, a good enough boxer that the Bruins wanted to give you a scholarship for it.
That's right.
So you're in pretty good physical shape before this happens.
Very good shape.
Uh-huh.
But that dwindled fast.
Yeah. So how much do you think you weighed before the war?
Oh, maybe 135 pounds or something. And we were down to about 100.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very difficult life overall and the way things happened.
And, you know, people today, some of the reference points they have to this experience, maybe one of the most well-known would be your friend Louis Zamperini, and they've seen the movie Unbroken or they've read that book by Laura Hillenbrand.
Yes.
Or read Louis' book.
Louis Zamperini happened to be in my camp,
mm-hmm.
So I knew real well what he wrote about.
So when he wrote about being tortured?
Yes.
You experienced similar things?
Well, life itself was a torture. And it's just something you had to learn to endure.
How often did you think about your brother or your sister or your cousins, your family back here?
Quite often you think of what life is like to be with your family. Yes.
I've had a lot of ex-prisoners of war give me different perspectives on some of the things they did in captivity to focus their minds or to remain hopeful. Some guys would daydream about all the things they were going to eat when they got out or the business they were going to start.
You always think about that, what you're going to eat when you get out. That's the primary thought.
So what was that for you? Was there something you were really looking forward to?
No, I just learned to accept things as they were and hope for something better.
I don't ask this to be salacious or melodramatic or anything like that, but just so we understand what it was really like. What were some of the most challenging things or circumstances that your Japanese captors made you endure?
Well, first, we didn't eat enough. We were always hungry. So they knew what our limit were and everything, and things were difficult. It's hard to accept some of the things we had to endure.
And I'm sure it was different at different times in different camps, but could you give us an example of like what a daily ration might be that they gave you to eat or drink?
It would vary. Sometimes we would eat good, sometimes we wouldn't eat at all. So it would vary. It's nothing that would be steady. You just learn to accept things as they are for the moment.
And as far as the Japanese, were there some who treated you better than others?
Well, there's always one or two that are different than the others, but overall, you don't get much help.
And how much of an idea did you have, or how much information did you have about what was happening outside of your prison camps?
Oh, you hear rumors and all that, but you learn that most of the things are not valid and things, and you just accept them as they come. It's a hard life.
And so when you guys were surrendered to the Japanese, you were 23.
Yes.
And then you had your 24th birthday, your 25th birthday, your 26th birthday, all as a prisoner.
Yes.
And I'm just thinking specifically about those birthdays, because I know you're looking forward to your 103rd birthday here in July.
Yes.
When you're in prison camp and your birthday comes around, are you even aware that it's your birthday? Do you know what day it is?
Well, you accept it as it is, but it's not very pleasant, you mm-hmm. know.
Were there some things that happened during your time as a prisoner that might have been mundane in normal life, but meant a lot to you given the circumstances?
Well, you learn to take it on a day-by-day basis because you can never do any planning or anything. It's a day-to-day thing.
And what were some of the things that the Japanese required you to do?
Whenever they could, they'd put us to work, and we would have to do labor and things that we were not accustomed of doing.
And I imagine if you're not eating much, you don't have much strength either.
Your energy level is very low, so you just do the best you can.
And how would they react if one of you was unable to do what they asked you to do?
They would do many unpleasant things that would make it difficult you to enjoy life as a whole. It's a difficult life all around. Just to survive was important. So that's what you thought of the most. How am I going to survive all this?
Well, and I guess that's the biggest question. As we look to your example and we marvel at the fact that you're still here and still able to tell this story, the biggest question is, how did you survive? How'd you do it?
It's a mind over matter thing. You have to think positive that eventually it's going to end.
We mentioned Louis Zamperini. And if people have read his book, they know about the deal he made with God when he was floating on the raft.
Yeah, I was in the same camp with Louis Zamperini. So I knew most of his thinking because he would talk about things. It was just a bad situation overall.
Had you known who he was because of his track days at USC?
Well, yes, I knew who he was, and I was real close to him. We were just in a bad situation overall, and it was something we could not control.
And people who have read his book or seen the movie, one of the characters that was a real-life character that they'll never forget after digesting that was a guy he called the Bird. I think you had another nickname for him,
well,
right?
Well, the Bird was the disciplinary officer, and he was in charge of discipline on all the prisoners.
And you called him the Wily Bird?
That's what we would named him, the Wily Bird.
Watanabe was his name.
He would always come up with things that were not too pleasant.
We got the sense from Louis's stories, and I had him on this program sharing his story, that the bird almost seemed to enjoy picking on you American prisoners.
He preferred the American rather than the British and the other prisoners they had, because they felt they were overwhelmed by the Americans.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth. I'm just using that as a reference point because I know what Louis said about him, that he became the kind of figure that a lot of you prisoners would fear or would try to avoid if you could.
Well, you always tried to avoid the Japanese, especially the disciplinary officers. They were brutal.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can give us an example of that, of how they carried out that discipline.
Well, they wouldn't feed you if they felt they didn't have to, and it's just things that you don't expect. You expect a decent thing, and they do the reverse.
There's a well-known example that Louis told that is depicted in the film Unbroken, which you got to go to the premiere for with your son as a special guest. There's a scene in that film where they show Louis holding a railroad tie.
Yeah.
Did that really happen?
It actually happened. Yes, it did.
And is that something you were subjected to also?
Yes. We were all subjected to something of a kind. There was no exceptions.
And anybody who's seen that, just seen it depicted on film when it's not even really real, they can imagine and try to run through in their mind, how would I handle that? How would I try to survive that?
Yes. It is very difficult to imagine things that happen that are actually happening. You just learn to endure them. And that's the way that things would go.
If you've never seen the film Unbroken, this weekend would be a great time to watch it for the first time. You'll see some of what you've been hearing about. And if you'd like to hear Mr. Sanchez's late friend, Louis Zamperini, when he shared his story on this program, we have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. It's break time again, but when we come back, what it felt like for this ex-prisoner of war to finally taste freedom again. We're also going to hear some perspective from his son, who journeyed back to Japan with him to see some of the places where his father endured such hardships. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation today with 102-year-old William Sanchez of Monterey Park, California. Captured on Corregidor 79 years ago this week, he found a way to survive day after day for the next 1,200 days as a prisoner of war. Were there ever days where you woke up and felt, I don't know if I can do this anymore?
Many, many a day. How much longer do I have to do this?
And again, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. I'm just wanting to understand how you really felt and what your experience was really like. But a situation like that, those circumstances that no one would ever choose, how does that affect your view of God or your feeling as to whether it's worthwhile to pray or if anyone's ever going to help you? Is that something that was relevant for you?
Sometimes you wonder if there's any help. It's very difficult to go through the things you have to endure, because where do they come up with these ideas? It's not an easy life.
And I don't want to leave anything out that would be important to you, but one thing I'm sure that a lot of people be interested in and hopefully is a little more pleasant memory for you. And I know there's a lot of things that happened over the time from the time you became a prisoner to when you were liberated. But help me understand what it was like when you guys started to realize, hey, the end is near and we may get to taste freedom again.
It's a very, very good feeling to think that you're going to have freedom again. Just the thought of it makes it exceptional. You always think the best is going to happen. You never think of the worst. It's always the best.
Where were you, and can you help me understand what it was like when that taste of freedom finally showed up again?
Oh, exhilarating. I was a prisoner in a prison camp when they finally decided to surrender. And boy, that was a great day.
How did you hear about it?
They let us know about it, that such and such is going to happen. And they made you aware of everything, so we were pretty much up to date on what is happening.
Did the Japanese treat you differently after that news?
Well, they had no power at all. The Americans took care of us and what our needs were. But it was a great feeling just to be free. It was just something you experience once in a lifetime. Freedom. You realize what the word freedom really means.
And you've had a long time to look back on those days. I mean, we're talking about more than 75 years now since you were liberated.
Yes, I would never want to go through it again.
And we certainly don't blame you. We wouldn't want to go through it either.
Life can be beautiful.
Well, I'm just wondering what kind of perspective your experience as a prisoner added to your life since then.
Well, you learn to look at things differently, and you never know what to expect. But there are difficult things in life that are going to happen, and you have to learn to accept them.
So when you got liberated, what was the first thing you wanted to do?
Have something good to eat.
What was it?
Well, anything, something good. Just have a good feeling that you're eating something pleasant.
What was the worst thing you ever had to eat as a prisoner?
Oh, gosh. We ate mostly scraps, so there was nothing good about lunchtime. Things were tough, and we knew we had to endure them.
And before you came home, back to California, you actually ended up in a very unique place on September 2nd, 1945, 2.5 weeks or so after the Japanese declared their intent to surrender. They actually had some dignitaries that came aboard the USS Missouri in Tokyo Bay and signed the instruments of surrender.
Yes.
And we've seen the pictures. General MacArthur was there, and Admiral Nimitz was there, and this skinny General Wainwright was there.
All the big shots were there, yes. That was a happy day for all of us.
Well, and somebody else was there.
MacArthur.
How about Sanchez?
Yeah, I was right in the middle of things. But we were so grateful just to be free. It made all the difference in the world.
How did you end up on the Missouri that day for that ceremony?
They took us there. They made a special thing to take us to be present there at the Missouri. And we just accepted the occasion. It's good to be free.
So you took advantage of that freedom.
That's right.
When you came back to the States.
Yes.
Was there any thought in your mind about remaining in the Army and making it a career?
No. I wanted to get into life itself.
So you took advantage of the GI Bill.
Yes.
Went to college.
Went to college and accepted what I learned and took advantage of it.
You got to go back to Japan.
Yes, I did.
Not too long ago.
Yes.
With some other ex-prisoners of war.
That's right.
What were some of the things you got to do there, and what was it like for you all those years later?
Well, the one thing is you get treated so differently that you begin to wonder, where was all this happening? You know, it just makes things so different to go back and pay a visit. You wonder how it all could happen. It was a very difficult experience and one that you will never forget. You wonder how one human can be as bad to another as it happened. It's so good to enjoy freedom. You don't realize it till you lose it.
William Sanchez, 102 years old. We'll get some final thoughts from him in a moment, but I also want you to hear from his son, David, who a few years back got to accompany his dad back to Japan to visit the Omori prison camp and other places where his father's will to survive had carried him through. What kind of perspective did all of that leave you with, David?
You know, I've had the opportunity in my life to listen to his stories and to hear them. And over the years, there's been so many more come out. When I was very young, I would only hear about, you need to eat your peas and carrots. I'd have given anything in prison camp to have that food to eat. But as I got older and he got older, he got in with a group of individuals at the Veterans Administration out in West LA, a group of ex-POWs, and he started to share a lot more stories. And because of his longevity in life, I've been afforded to really hear what really happened. Because if we were unfortunate enough to lose him at a much younger age, those stories would have gone with him. But he's really opened up over the years and has shared those stories with us, and it's really amazing. He deserves a lot of respect. He's got all the love in the world, but just the respect that he deserves from all of his past service to our country. And he's got so many stories of what he's done. And over the years now, probably the last four or five, the stories have shortened significantly. I was fortunate enough to hear him when he was finally comfortable speaking about these stories, to be present, to hear the long version. You're getting more the Cliff Note version now. But the main thing is he's always been such a positive individual. You know, don't sweat the small stuff and don't dwell on things that you don't have control over, because they're going to happen. Try to put all your energy into things you can control. And I've really been blessed with having such a good mother and father in my life. And it's a really great thing. Because of his longevity, I know his stories inside and out. And I can't imagine what he's gone through. Just in the March of Shame, which followed the Bataan Death March, how he was fortunate enough to have 2/3 of a canteen of water that many men didn't have, and how he shared it with the other individuals. And he picked up a pebble and put it between his cheek and gum, so to speak, to create saliva. And he shared his water. I don't know if a lot of other people, especially me in that situation, would have done that. I might not have let anybody know that I had 2/3 of a canteen of water. And his big line was, sip it, don't gulp it. But he would share that water, and he told me that Min made it back because of that. And I want to say, once he was a prisoner, he was very smart, and he learned to speak katakana and to recognize a lot of the symbols. And so when he worked as a stevedore, they would unload trains and load ships that were going out to supply the Japanese army, or they would unload cargo ships and load up the trains that would take the food to other parts of Japan. He would tell the honchos who were in charge of the groups, the Americans and the British and the Dutch, he would read what was inside. And he said the British taught him how to pinch. And he would tell the honcho, hey, we'll take track number 4, this boxcar. He knew there were soybeans in there or medicines that could help, and they would take a little bit and sneak them back into the POW camp. And he says soybeans were a big thing for him and the other POWs, as well as the medicines for the sick prisoners. And the thing about the Japanese, he would tell me that if you didn't work, you didn't eat, so that they would share some of the little food that they had with the sick prisoners to try to keep them alive. So they all pulled together, and those are some very good stories. And I get my gift of languages from my father, you know, him speaking English and Spanish. And he loved going to the Philippines when he first went over there because he could speak Spanish as well as English. The Filipino people treated him really well, and he was almost a celebrity. When he first got there, he had to go through basic training there before he was turned to duty. So he did his basic training in the Philippines under a Sergeant Mitchell and a Corporal Kelly that he says taught him to survive and really trained him well. And he said the first day, Kelly and Mitchell came out and says, "Who's Sanchez?" And my dad's, "Oh, wow, who knows me? Who's heard about me? What's coming up?" And he said, "I'm Sanchez." He said, they told him, "We served with the Sanchez in Panama, and he was a great soldier. If we make you half the soldier he was, you will make it in this man's army." So he knew right away, oh boy, they've got my number. But he went through the training, and he became a sharpshooter. He missed expert by 1 point. He said some of the guys would miss, and they'd call it Maggie's drawers. They would run a pair of underwear up a pole, or they would show the spotters what the score was. They would hold up some underwear, and they called it Maggie's drawers. But his big thing was when they had to qualify for swimming. My father is a very, very, very strong swimmer. And when he came and they jumped in the pool, he did a couple different strokes. They had to swim a few lengths of the pool. And Kelly and Mitchell were saying, "You think you're some Johnny Weissmuller, Sanchez." And they were making fun of him. And he was just gliding through the pool. And he enjoyed his time in the Philippines before he was turned to duty. They assigned him to the 59th Coast Artillery. They had the 59th and the 60th. The 60th was anti-aircraft, and the 59th were in charge of the big guns. There was a lot of boxing going on. They had a baseball team over there, a lot of activity on Corregidor. He said it was like a club, like a country club. They had like a cable car line that ran from the docks up to Middleside and up to Topside Barracks. And while he was going through training, there was the 59th and the 60th. A guy from the 59th, a boxer, had dropped out. So they were asking if there was anybody in the 59th who could pick up a boxing match. And Dad saw it as a way to get out of duty for a couple weeks. So he said, "I can fight." So they treated him real well. And he got to train for a couple weeks. And he went in there the night of the fight. It was a big smoker. And he went in there. And a lot of his friends that came from California with him were in the 60th, but they were cheering for him, and they were wondering, some of the people, how come Sanchez is getting people from the 60th cheering for him? And he went in there, and I always tease him that he was just looking for a soft spot to land when he went in there. But after the first round, he said, "Hey, I can take this guy." And he took the fight just to get out of the duty, like I said, but he ended up winning the fight for that weight class. And he had an embroidered, a white jacket that was embroidered with his name on it for the 59th champ in that division. And he said when they left the island that that was one possession that he was really sad that he lost, that he could not take with him. And he talks about that jacket often, that because it said champ on it, I think, and he loved boxing so much. Leave it to Dad to always come up with, "Hey, I can get out of this duty or do that." And it was because of his typing skills that he got transferred to headquarters, Manila and Subic Bay. And he got to go to work in the Malinta Tunnel under General George Moore. That was before Wainwright came, and of course before MacArthur came. But because of his typing, he got into the Army Intelligence, and he left the big guns. And so he was in on a lot of the, you know, he was hearing a lot of the decisions that would be made before they were made, you know, before they were official and most of the other men would hear about them. But he was privy to a lot of information, and I don't know if he was in the right place at the right time, but I like to say he was always in the wrong place at the wrong time, the way things turned out for him.
Well, and if they didn't turn out the way they turned out for him, there would be no you.
Oh, that's for sure. We'd probably be doing this interview with somebody else in Japanese right now. We wouldn't be speaking English, that's for sure.
And speaking of Japanese, you got to go with your dad back to Japan?
We went back on a friendship tour, and it was really great. Of course, I love history, And when I got the list of gentlemen that would be going with us, thank God for the computer and Google and a few of the websites, and I had background information on all of them. So I knew their stories somewhat. And when we first met, I was able to throw little tidbits in there, and they're like, how does this guy know about us? And it was really helpful. And it was a great opportunity to go back there with my father. After the war, he got his degree in international trade and finance, and he went and did a lot of business with the Japanese. He used his ability to speak the language, and more important than language, the culture of the people. He made several trips to Japan before that trip that we made. And I had always heard of where his prison camp and where it was and what was there today. It was great just going back there with him and getting to experience that with him and to meet the other POWs, and they got along famously. They like to say that we ate a lot of the same dirt together, and it was amazing how you could go and meet the sons and daughters of the other POWs, and we were strangers to each other, but we had so many commonalities, and the stories that we shared were like, oh, my dad did that too. Your dad does that? You're kidding. I thought nobody else in the world did that. Oh, my dad did that too. So did mine. It was like you're going on a trip with strangers, but we all got along famously, the sons and the daughters. There was one prisoner of war that was still using the word Jap and not really happy with the Japanese people. And one of our stops was at Temple University in Tokyo. And the POWs got to speak. And one of the questions they ask is, when did you forgive? And my father's answer was, as soon as I got home, I hit the ground running. I forgave them. They had a job to do, and I had a job to do. But he didn't harbor the hate. And when they got to the one prisoner of war who was cantankerous, I turned to a new good friend of mine, Jack Schwartz, and I said, this week. And darned if he didn't answer, you know what? I'm starting to forgive now. I think this week I have forgiven them. So each of the prisoners of war went through different levels of forgiveness. And I tell you, I don't think I could have done it. What I know he went through, it would have been really hard for me to go through something like that. And my hat's off to the guy for doing that. And he never harbored the hatred. Like I said earlier, when he came home, he forgave them. And to be back, and I'll never forget Jack Schwartz's father. He was talking about the toilet. I never had a warm toilet seat my whole prisoner of war time in Japan. I thought that was hilarious. He was one of the most brilliant minds I've ever met. And then Warren Jorgensen, 4th Marines. The Marines are tough. Oh, my God. His son Larry told me, oh, my God, my dad couldn't figure out the toilet. He started pressing the buttons. And darn if he didn't activate the duvet, and he got himself all wet. And I walked into the bathroom, and he's fighting with the toilet. A U.S. Marine fighting with a Japanese toilet. And he had to change him before we went out to a very nice dinner that was hosted for us. And, like, it was just such a great experience to go with Dad to Japan and to walk on the hallowed ground and to meet the other prisoners of war and to become friends with their sons and daughters.
Was there something that you saw there that made things more real for you? Because you'd heard these stories your whole life. You'd had certainly the perspective that he picked up from that experience influencing your life. But was there something you saw or felt or experienced that helped you see things in a whole new light?
Something that the POWs said was something I had felt. They were amazed at the country that Japan had become at that time. They never imagined that it would be such a modern city. And I was also taken aback of what a great country it was. And the people, how, I don't know the word to say, how they were, like, you know, they love their country. They would do anything for their country. And it's their way of life. Like, I don't know if Americans have their own train of thought about the way things should be, and their Americans are happy to voice it because of the way we brought up and the beautiful country we live in. And it was really something to see the country from my eyes, what it has become, and just how the people were and the way it is over there. And it was really, really a good experience to see and to experience it with the other POWs. They had many, many good stories to share. You were asking Dad earlier about, did some treat you better than the others? And Dad was saying, oh, yeah, there's always one or two. There was one gentleman who said that him and his buddy had stolen food from a guard, and they thought they were done the next day, that they would be executed. And that day that they stole the food, the guard said, okay, tomorrow I will bring two lunches. I will bring one for me and one for you. So they were very fortunate that they ran into a sympathetic Japanese guard. And that was a story that I brought home that I couldn't believe. My dad said that never would have happened in his camp. And he was talking about the camp disciplinarian, Mutsuhiro Watanabe. And Dad was saying how he had a lot of more aggression towards the Americans. And I've heard that several times, that the Japanese didn't feel inferior to anybody, but they felt if anybody could stand up to them, it would be the Americans. And so because of that, the treatment of the Americans was a little more brutal, a little more harsh. Dad always said that Watanabe, he didn't answer to the camp commander, that he went to several camps. When there were prisoners that needed, quote-unquote, softening, that they would send Watanabe in. And so that he just was not assigned only to Camp Omori. He went to several of the camps, and he would do the softening, if you will.
Well, and that takes me back to Unbroken, because here you and your father are at the premiere of this mega movie, but it's not just a made-up story. As you're watching that on the screen, sitting next to your dad, knowing that he endured some of the same torture that's being depicted on that big screen, what was that like?
Oh, my God. That was an amazing night. We were very fortunate to get to go to that event. We knew that they were making the movie because Dad had talked to Louis. Dad had also been called in to Universal Studios a couple times just to give a little input, to do an interview. They really wanted, Angelina Jolie and Universal really wanted to do a good job in telling the story right. And it was great to go to that event. We knew the movie was coming out. Unfortunately, Louis passed away in July, and the movie premiered in December. Louis led such a good life. He was so positive. His faith in God and his love of people. He was really in a good place. And Louis was to be the Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade in that January. And he had contacted my father and three other POWs. He said, I want you to ride in a car behind me. There's going to be you four guys from the West LA POWs. And just unfortunately, Louis passed away in July. And my father spoke at his memorial. At one of them, at Torrance High School. He went out there and he got to meet his son. I believe his name was Luke, and his daughter. And he got to speak. They had a spot for him waiting, and Dad drove out there. He spoke at that event. And then because Louis passed away, they made Dad the guest of honor at the Hollywood premiere. And we were fortunate enough to walk the red carpet. And it was another event that I've got to share with my father that I'll never forget. You know, they were telling us that, okay, you will walk at this time. You will come at the carpet. Universal had assigned an intern to us, and she was such a nice gal. And she told us what was coming off, what to expect. And while we were waiting there in the foyer before we walked in to the theater, you know, so many people were coming up to Dad and thanking him for his service. They knew that he was one of the ex-POWs that had been invited to the premiere. And they did a great job with that. They had invited many heroes. You know, not just servicemen and women. They invited people who had overcome cancer or Down syndrome to really show other individuals what is possible. A lot of those people were in athletics or literature or film, and it's just, there were just a good bunch of people there. And that was a great experience to go to that Hollywood premiere. I remember our time came and we were there, and all of a sudden two big bouncers came up and said, stop. And from the right out of a door came Brad Pitt, his mom and dad, and four of their kids. My dad, what's the holdup? I said, Dad, you know, Brad Pitt is walking in front of us. Angelina had gotten the chicken pox, I believe, of the measles, and she wasn't able to attend the Hollywood premiere. And so so Brad Pitt with his mom, dad, and four kids are walking in front of us, and we had to wait. And my dad's like, do you think we're going to miss the movie, David? Oh, no, Dad, they're not going to start. And so something that might have been a negative to some people was a positive for us, because we followed Brad Pitt and his family, and he had to do the talking for Angelina, his wife. And so our time on the red carpet was extended quite a bit because we followed them, and so we were going at a very slow pace. Along the route on the right was a big wall with, you know, it had unbroken poster board on it, and on the left were paparazzi, and in front of each group was, okay, this is this magazine, this is this news channel, and the intern told us, when you get to stop 17, they're going to interview your dad. And so we went along, we followed Brad Pitt, and just really had a long, long time on the red carpet, and more than most people get to experience, I'm sure. Very few people get to experience anything like that. But for people like us who do get to experience, our time was elongated considerably because we followed Brad Pitt and his family. Then when we got to that stop, they interviewed Dad, and he did a really good job and spoke. And then I was really happy when the last paparazzi were CCTV from China. And I went up and I started speaking to them in Chinese, and boy did their eyes get big that somebody actually acknowledged them, because they were the last on the list. But after that, we got to go into the lobby, and the intern asked us, what would you like, you know? She showed us to our seats, and then she said, what would you like? And it's like, oh wow, well, we'll have popcorn, COVID, and darn if she didn't go and get it. And then she came back and brought it to us, and I asked her where she was going to watch. She goes, no, I can't watch. I'll be here, and I'll meet you as soon as it's over. Don't leave the seats. I'll come and get you, and then I'm taking you to an after party. And boy, before that movie started, darn if it wasn't the director, because that was Angelina Jolie, but they came out and said, we have a lot of people in the audience. He said a couple names and people clapped. They didn't stand up or anything, but then he came out with, we have an extremely special guest, our guest of honor, and he did a little background on Dad, and then had him stand up, and my God, what a great experience. The whole theater was clapping, and just for him, I turned and I looked at Brad Pitt, who I'm happy to say was a few rows behind us, and he was clapping too for Dad. It was a very, very, very good thing to see. And of course, after the movie, the intern told us not to leave our seats. It's like we couldn't leave because so many people came up after the movie to come and, you know, thank Dad's hand, shake his hand, ask him to sign something, pat him on the back. Some had tears in their eyes. It was just a great experience. But I want to share with you one thing during the movie. He always credits the British for helping him get through prison camp once he was in Tokyo, because once he got there, he was with the British primarily, because he was in a camp where there was devoid of American POWs, and he was in the first group of American prisoners of war that went right into Tokyo. There were other American POWs in other parts of Japan, but he was in the first group that went right into Tokyo, and in his camp were primarily British, and he said they taught him to survive, their sense of humor, and he's got a lot. He so many good stories. But while we were watching the movie, there was one part where the Wily Bird comes up to Louis and tells him he's being transferred, and they're watching, it's Christmas time, and the British are putting on a play. You have to remember, I'm inside of a theater, and it's very quiet in there. But all of a sudden, this play comes on the screen, and my dad says, I remember that play. Oh, it was hilarious. Cinderella and those two stepsisters, they were syphilis and gonorrhea. Oh, my God. And I'm like, Dad, be quiet, be quiet. This is a theater. And, like, people are turning around and looking at him. And, you know, he's usually more well-reserved and quiet. But that jogged a memory that was just, I had never heard that story, obviously. And it was just, he remembered that. And Louis on the raft for so long, my dad was saying, I was in the hull of a ship for 35 days before we got to Tokyo. Once we left Manila, and the ship broke down, and then they kept getting torpedoed, so they'd have to turn back, and then they went to Busan, Korea, and there were 1,000 men that got off the ship, including General Wainwright, and then he stayed on with 200, and they went right into Tokyo, but it was a trip that should have taken a week, took him 35 days that he was in the hull of a ship. But that was another memory he had, seeing Louis on the raft. He said, well, Louis was on that raft, and I was in the hull of a ship. He's had a lot of stories to tell me about that trip, but I won't share them now. There's too many and too long.
Let's conclude with this, because I, as you described you know, the ovation he received in the theater during the premiere of Unbroken. It almost sounded like a moment where all of a sudden everybody else saw him the way it sounds like you've seen him for a long time. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but maybe you can help us understand why your father is held in such great esteem and respect, what it is that you appreciate and admire about him.
You are very perceptive. You're spot on with that question, because there's been a few opportunities I've been afforded in my life and things I've gone to with my father where he's treated with the respect that he's earned in his life. And that was one of them, because that story really brought to light what the Americans went through. And it was just a great, great thing to see, you know, what the American servicemen and women, especially the nurses, went through. And it was so great to see him getting the accolades. He's never been in it for the accolades. He doesn't share the story unless you ask him about it. So many people say, oh, I never knew that about your dad. On one trip, he was invited to place the wreath of flowers on the memorial on Corregidor to the American servicemen and women. So I went to the Philippines with him several years ago. And when I was there, wow, was really seeing him get the respect he deserves. When he placed that wreath of flowers on the memorial to the servicemen and women, and just seeing the ovation and the clapping he was getting, and how he knelt down and put the flowers down and said a prayer. And exactly at 12 o'clock, the sun comes over the top of this rotunda that has a hole in it, and it illuminates the marble tabernacle. And the flowers were on top, and the sun came over, and it was just a surreal moment. But our whole time in the Philippines, they have a holiday, April the 9th, that our President Bush made National POW Day that we had never had before. But in the Philippines, it's a national holiday. They never forget. And the Filipino people treated my father like I had never seen before, because I had never been to the Philippines prior. And it's like, wow, he doesn't get that treatment at home. You know, and it was just a really moment to see when we were in the Philippines and at Unbroken and at many events we've gone to that he's spoken at. But those people are, they love the history and they know a little bit about his story. But going into that trip in the Philippines was really such a good moment, and the Hollywood premiere of Unbroken as well. Because, you know, I'm so proud of what my father has done for our country. You know, it's a sacrifice that I know I couldn't do. My dad said a lot of guys just gave up, that they laid down and died, and there was not really anything wrong with them. They just couldn't endure it anymore. And then he talks about the mental aspect, that the guys who were a little bit older than the 19-year-olds had a little bit more experience, and they could cope with it better. And I tell you, I don't think I could have done it, what I know he went through. It would have been really hard for me to go through something like that, and my hat's off to the guy for doing that. And he never harbored the hatred. Like I said earlier, when he came home, he forgave them. And I really believe it was his faith in God that kept him going. That was a big part of it. He's a man of faith, and it kept him going during that time. And his experiences, he had a hard life as a child, being orphaned and being sick. But he always tries to look at the positive things, and I know those experiences helped him to get through what he was enduring at that time. You know, he had been through several hardships, and this was another one that was put in front of him. And all that experience in his faith got him home and got him back to us. And thank God, because we wouldn't be doing this interview.
You can hear more of David Sanchez's thoughts about his father in the podcast version of this episode at hometownheroesradio.com, including what it was like to accompany his dad to the Hollywood premiere of Unbroken. But before we run out of time on the radio, I want you to hear more from Mr. Sanchez himself. When Unbroken came out, when people read the book, when people saw the movie, millions of people who had never heard any of those stories before were made aware of them. Do you think that's good?
Well, the things that we had to endure while in captivity should always be learned by the people.
Well, I'm curious. Maybe you've given this some thought, maybe you haven't. But is there something at age 102 and a half that you would say you're most thankful for or most proud of?
The most proud of things that you can be thankful for is freedom. One word. That's it. It's very, beautiful just to be free.
I don't want to finish without saying thank you. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for enduring what you had to endure so you could tell us this story.
Well, it was a very difficult time. Fortunately, I always think of how lucky I am that I went through it.
There's some people who wouldn't be here if you didn't.
Yes. The secret is to think positive. No matter how bad things are, eventually they're going to get better.
Well, thank you very much for letting us into your world a little bit. I know it's not all easy to talk about.
It's a hard world, but I'm glad to be alive. Thank you.
William Sanchez. Maybe you know him as Bill, maybe as Willie, but come July, you can wish him a happy 103rd birthday. You can link to photos and more information about Mr. Sanchez's remarkable story at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Thank you so much for spending this hour with us today. Mr. Sanchez expressed it a lot more powerfully than I ever could, but I'll say it again just because that's how we finish the program each and every time, by reminding each other that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.